seminar of the Millennium Academic Year. I'm Meghna Desai. I'm a professor of economics here and a director of the Center of the Study of Global Governance. We have today an unusual event. It's an innovation. As some of you would know, ever since Tony Giddens came to the LSE, he has been giving lectures, lunchtime lectures, open to students. And this has been a very good tradition. This year we thought, before when he gave his first lecture, we would have some other people present as well. This is like the first inaugural lecture of this year by Tony Giddens, along with three other distinguished members of the LSE faculty. And they are all going to tackle the problem of globalization. So in a sense, this is just the beginning, and there will be many more lectures to come. I should also say that those of you who have been here for a long time will know that there are events going on all the time at LSE. And on Friday at 5:30 in the Old Theater, there is an open meeting on financial crisis and global governance. It's open to all, and it's a public meeting to which people, some activists and economists, are going to be there. My pleasant task this evening is to introduce the speakers and say very little myself. We will listen to the four speakers. Then we will have a short sort of discussion among the speakers. And after that, I will ask for questions from the audience. I know that at this moment there are people sitting in the Old Theater, and this debate is hooked up with the Old Theater. So there is people here and people there. Last time I addressed a big meeting like this, we were hoping to occupy the LSE, but that was, 32 years ago. but that's another story. When we take questions, it will not be possible to take questions from the Old Theater. We will take questions from the Peacock only. And when you are asking questions, please wait till a mic is brought to you, because we are recording the meeting and we are going to transcribe and put it on the net. So without any further ado, let me first introduce Tony Giddens. He is the director of LSE. He's a distinguished sociologist. I think he practically invented globalization single-handedly long, long ago, or certainly was the first person to write on the wide significance of globalization as a social and political force to which we all had to sort of respond to. And over the years, he has done many other innovative things, including his writing on the Third Way. And despite all that, he manages to run the LSE and give lots and lots of lectures. So we are all very grateful to him, and I'll now ask Tony to give a lecture, a short one.
Okay, well, welcome everybody. Let me add my welcome to that of the distinguished Lord Desai, and let me say this event. Especially I'd like to welcome new students at the LSE and anyone like Steve Kennedy who's come out from the outside to attend this debate. The LSE is just a fantastic intellectual environment, it truly is, and Meghna just said there are lots of other events going on. If you are new to the LSE, please come to some of these events. Many of them are public events. We have extraordinarily distinguished speakers always coming to the LSE. So this is one tiddly bit of a massive ongoing debate, really, in the LSE. This event was set up partly to introduce the lectures that I give to the LSE community that start about halfway through the term on Wednesdays at lunchtime. They're not just about globalization. They're about this grand political debate about the future of the centre-left, which is a truly global debate, but globalization certainly figures there. Each of the other speakers have their own concerns, which I think this event also links to, which I'm sure they'll mention when they come to talk. We've only got 7 minutes each to talk about globalization, so here is my quick take on the globalization debate. Globalization debate has moved through two phases. Up to about 3 or 4 years ago, the core of the debate about globalization, which incidentally you can define in its simplest sense as increasing global interdependence, that debate up until recently was about whether the phenomenon exists at all. There were many people who felt that all the talk about globalization did not signify a reality. And these people have sometimes come to be called the globalization skeptics. They argued that, for example, if you look back to the late 19th century, you already had then open markets, you had a good deal of trade in currencies, you had a lot of migration across the world. People didn't even need passports for the most part in the 19th century. So they said, well, what's new about the contemporary phase? Maybe all the talk about globalization is simply hype. There's been a lot of research since then, and my view anyway, for what it's worth, is that that debate is over. The first globalization debate is now over. Anyone, I feel, who studied the phenomenon in depth recognizes that this is a new era. The current global age is not just a replica of the past, whatever affinities it might have with it. There are massive changes affecting our world. The globalization debate itself has become global in a way that simply would not have been possible before the advent of very recent global communication systems. The second globalization debate is now underway. That debate is not about whether globalization exists, it's about what the consequences of globalization are. And that debate, as everyone sitting in the audience will know, is not just an intellectual debate, it's not just an academic discussion, it's brought people out into the streets. Since the meetings in Seattle, going through to the anti-capitalist carnivals in London, to massive demonstrations in Buenos Aires when the IMF were there, to Prague more recently, there is a massive confrontation around the whole notion of globalization and what it means for us. I think in a way, although there's a good deal of violence in all this on the streets, it's right and proper, because the globalization debate, to me anyway, is perhaps the most important debate that's going on currently, because it is a debate about how we can shape the big changes affecting our lives in such a way as to try to settle the fate of this century. The unfolding shape of this century will be very strongly influenced by how we react to the debate about globalization. What were the people on the streets of Seattle saying? Well, we know they were disparate groups. We know, I think, that they were not just people who were for globalization and against globalization. I think we know that the protesters are themselves, as it were, part and parcel of globalizing processes, because they used, for example, the internet to assemble there. In his Reith lectures, Chris Patton gave a very funny example of a placard that was being held up in Seattle. Someone was saying, join the worldwide movement against globalization. Well, that shows you that you're dealing with the contact, the friction, the dialogue between what you might call globalization from above and globalization from below. In the streets, people were against, in quotes, globalization. In the meetings, in the plush meeting rooms, people of the WTO, IMF, are, quote, for globalization. To me, these positions are both incoherent. You cannot take such a position. The reason being that globalization is a complex phenomenon. It is not a single phenomenon. It comes from more than one source. To me, perhaps the dominant source is actually changes in communications. It should not, in my view anyway, just be identified either with liberal market policies or indeed with the expansion of the global economy. I believe that there's a much more profound restructuring of global institutions going on, to which phenomena such as the ending of the Cold War and other dynamic influences make a contribution. So to me, you can't be for it or against it. You have to disentangle the undeniably, I think, positive aspects of a more global cosmopolitan world from the harmful and destructive ones. And there's no doubt also that they do exist. Now, the people in the streets, I think, there are at least two phenomena they were concerned about. There were more, but two that I'll mention in my 7 minutes. One, corporate power. Is it true that corporations run the world? If so, that surely can't be right and proper. Second, inequality. Is it true that expanding globalizing processes are producing a more unequal world? Well, 7 minutes, you ain't going to answer questions like that, so I'll simply dogmatically say what my views are. Yes, we need more regulation of corporate power. I believe we do. Yes, more regulation of corporate power is possible, but it has to be on a transnational as well as a national level. It has to involve incentives as well as negative regulations. It has to involve the sorts of things which OECD are now working on very centrally, for example, closing down of tax havens and more regulation of anonymous banking accounts. You do not want a world which is simply enthralled to corporate power. On the other hand, it's a fundamental mistake to demonize business, to demonize corporations, because you need corporate involvement for investment. You want corporations under the right conditions to invest in poorer countries. The question is how to achieve that. It would be stupid to simply say that corporate power should in some sense wholly be held back from the developing world. It's aptly been said that the only thing worse than being exploited by a multinational corporation is not being exploited by one, because you do want corporate investment, but only under regulated conditions. Second, does globalization increase inequality? Well, people on the street seem to think so, but if you look at the evidence, you cannot support that assertion. In this case, it doesn't matter what view of globalization you have. Even if you have a very thin view, which I don't think, as I said, you should have, in other words, globalization is free trade, if you look at the recent studies we have, there is no clear connection between the expansion of free trade and the development of inequalities. On the contrary, on the whole, open poor economies do much better than closed poor economies do, both in terms of growth rates. The comparison is zero growth over the last 15 years for closed poor economies, about 5% growth for open poor economies, and in the open poor economies, there is a reduction of inequality rather than an increase. Inequality fundamentally comes from other sources: corruption, the overextended power of states, technological change, demographic change, illness with the spread of AIDS in Africa, a cluster of factors. Globalization, to my mind anyway, engagement with the wider changes in the world is crucial for the less developed countries as it is for the more developed ones. No country which has cut itself off from the wider world has prospered. You only have to look at North Korea or Burma to see what it's like in a country which tries to simply isolate itself from the world economy. There is no future in regionalism. There is no future in blunt protectionism. That doesn't mean you should simply accept free trade. You should only, I think, open up industries to markets when you've got certain institutional conditions which prevail. Nevertheless, you do need to engage with a wider global economy, and the main question for poorer countries are the conditions of that engagement. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. That's also exemplary discipline. I didn't have to to say anything to stop you. Okay, our next speaker is Professor Fred Halliday. Fred Halliday has been a professor of international relations here for many years and has written many books. His latest book is called The World at 2000, Perils and Promises. These were some lectures Fred gave last year at the LSE. They were public lectures, and he has now made them into a book. Fred has also written Rethinking International Relations, and very recently a book on revolution and world politics. Fred Halliday.
Megdad, thanks very much. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here in this discussion of globalization. I had the great pleasure of traveling with Tony Giddens to the Middle East, to Kuwait in the spring, where he lectured on the same subject. And his visit was indeed a very good example of one aspect of globalization, because while the first question from the audience was about the WTO or trade liberalization, the second was about Arsenal and Tottenham Hotspur and so forth. And much of his visit, I won't say half of it, but close enough, it was taken up discussing with Kuwaiti audiences and donors and all the rest of it at the various success of British football teams. One area in which, curiously, Americanization is not equal to globalization. I want to suggest that there are some very boring things to say about globalization. One is to say that nothing has changed, and here I agree with Tony. Historical perspective is important, and we should look at the degrees of trade, investment, movement of peoples before the First World War, and we should also look, and this is a point Meghnad has often made, about why it failed. And it failed because of the inability of states to agree, a point to which I shall return. So the past is relevant. It's also relevant to say that some of the things which globalization promotes or which people talk about have happened before. When people say ideas are crossing the world today at a rapid speed, it's true they didn't have the microchip or CNN 50 or 500 or 1,000 years ago, but the ideas of Jesus Christ, the Prophet Muhammad, Mr. Martin Luther, Mr. Karl Marx, the American Revolution, these things also spread across frontiers in a very dramatic way. So to say that nothing has changed, or to say that everything has changed, is, I think, boring and inaccurate, and it leaves out the intellectual challenge, which is to say exactly what has changed. In some sense, we don't know, because we're all flying blind. I don't think any of us know, for example, how important the 10% of the US economy, which is made up by e-commerce, is going to be in the next 10 or 15 years. Maybe it will remain 10 or 15%. Maybe it will remain much more. I don't think any of us know, and this is an intellectual question, it's also a personal and even trade union question, what will be the effects of all this on teaching in universities? Are we really going to see such a profound change in universities over the next few years? We don't know. But I think we should try and keep some measure as to what is new and what is not new. And we should also keep in the back of our minds what is perhaps the most old-fashioned but ever relevant question which the British educational system poses: what exactly do you mean? Because very often in globalization, I think one loses sight of what exactly is being claimed, not least for the reason which Tony alluded to, which is that not everything is related to everything else. Changes in technology, growth in interest in religion, or decline in secularism in societies, changing family patterns, changing patterns of employment, changing patterns of trade, these may or may not be related to each other, but I think it's an illusion to think that they do. I want to look at four quick questions which fall under the globalization rubric. One, which Tony already touched on, is a question of inequality. The world is becoming a more and more unequal place in terms of income, in terms of life opportunities, in terms of technological change. The gap in terms of income is very striking. The gap between the top 20% and the poorest 20% of the world, as the UNDP has emphasized in its recent reports, has risen to 86-1 and is widening every day as we speak. I have here the latest UN World Investment Report. If you're gung-ho on globalization, you'll say, look, foreign direct investment has risen from about $300 billion or $400 billion a year in the early 1990s to close on $900 billion in the last year. It is an enormous increase in transfer of capital. However, 80% of that goes to OECD countries, and of the remaining 20%, which goes to emerging markets or third world countries, whatever you want to call them, nearly all of it, or over 50% of it, goes to just 10 countries, of which China is an obvious recipient. In other words, there are well over 100 countries in the world which are excluded by all practical measures from the global flow of investment. So you have income inequality, you have investment inequality, and then you have an issue which, to my mind, could be the most explosive of all, because it's the one that will have enormous political consequences. It's the question of employment. The gap between technological change in contemporary society and the creation of jobs is getting wider and wider. According to the ILO, and it's a very striking figure, for the next 50 years, we will have to create 30 million new jobs every year worldwide to employ those who are coming onto the labor market. And that just ain't happening. President-elect Vicente Fox was here only last week. He gave the figures for Mexico. Mexico needs to grow at 7% a year to employ or find employment for the 1.4 million people who are coming onto the labor market. And of course, nearly 400 million people, for 400,000 people are trying every year to get into the United States. The consequences of failing to address that within countries, the consequences for migration, the consequences for economic and political stability are enormous. And I don't believe that globalization as we see it is addressing it. So the first point I'd want to make is unless and until states and corporations address in a long-term way the inequalities and the consequent instabilities in globalization, it is not going to deliver either stability or prosperity for most of humanity. Which brings me to the second point, the point about states. We all know that this is a huge debate. Do states matter? Do they not? But why do people invest in one country and not in another? Not because of the natural resources. There are no natural resources in Singapore. There are very few in Ireland. They invest because of the educational system, which is a function of states, and they invest because of the stability and the good governance of those states. And where there is not good governance, and you know when you ain't got it, you may not be able to define it, but you know when you ain't got it, people do not invest. If states didn't matter in elections, nobody would be spending all this money on Mr. Bush and Mr. Gore. But they are spending a lot of money. Indeed, the question of campaign financing throughout the developed world, look at Germany, look at France, look at this country, look at the United States, look at Japan, is a central question, and that's because states still matter. The point that Meghnad has made before, that the future of globalization rests upon agreement between states, is, I think, a very important one indeed. If the Europeans make a mess of the euro, which I hope they don't, but I fear they may, well, it will be because of a failure of states. If the WTO fails, it will not, with all respect, because of the tree huggers and environmentalists and trade unions on the streets of Seattle. It will be because of the disagreement of states. And one final point, which is a sort of a piece of international relations patriotism, if I could make this point, more important than the question of globalization is the question of interstate security. We live in a world mercifully free of the threat of interstate nuclear war. We do not live in a world where the threat of interstate war has disappeared. And we will be lucky. We will be lucky to get through the next 25 years without a nuclear exchange in East Asia, involving China and its rivals, or in South Asia, involving India and Pakistan, or in the Persian Gulf, involving Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and other states. We will be lucky. We may do it, but it won't happen automatically. And that issue, which was the issue of 1914, is still with us.
Two more minutes.
The issue of human rights, the LSE is launching a human rights center this term, of which I happen to be the current director. A new course has just begun on it. I'm not at all convinced that globalization on balance is helping to promote human rights. Globalization is bad for labor rights. Globalization in multiple forms, which I need not go into here, is bad for gender rights. Globalization stokes up all sorts of nationalism and communalism, which is bad for the rights of individuals. And I think we need to pay much more attention to the ways in which globalization, while promoting universal norms, also serves to undermine human rights. Final point, which in a way is to agree with Tony, we face choices. There is a kind of zeitgeist at the moment, a spirit that these processes are inevitable and just happening. And we have, in a way, three fetishes of our age: the market, the microchip, and the genome. And the market, the microchip, and the genome can deliver various things. But they may also create great inequality. They may also be driven by short-term concerns of profit. And if they do, the world will end up as a more unstable and at least a more unequal place. So unless we subject them to democratic control and interstate cooperation, assisted by responsible protests from below, then these processes will in fact not lead to greater prosperity or greater stability. Final point I'd make is we've moved a long way from the 19th century view of globalization as the world becoming one place, one homogeneous place. There are 10,000 languages in the world. Some may disappear, but let's hope the diversity remains. There is, thank heavens, a diversity of foods and gastronomies in the world. Let us hope we don't end up eating the same food all over the world, whether it's what the French call Malbouf or anything else. I don't look forward to an age in which all universities are the same either. I think the homogenization of universities is also a mistake. They should learn from each other. They should keep their distant cultures. But that, too, involves a question of choice. And I think if there's anything that concerns me about the globalization issue beyond the question of inequality, it is this issue of reasserting the possibilities of choice, democratic choice, intellectual choice, cultural choice, and not just accepting this as an inevitable process. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred. Yes, indeed. I should have mentioned that Fred was is undertaking this human rights program planning for LSE for the future, and we're looking forward to his work on that. My next speaker is Mary Calder, who is a colleague of mine in the Center for Study of Global Governance. Mary has done many things, both as an activist in the international relations arena, as well as a scholar. Her last book was New and Old Wars, and her next book is on global civil society, because she's heading a program on global civil society at the center, which has been financed by MacArthur Foundation. Mary Calder.
Well, I too want to say what a privilege it is to be here and what an exciting place LSE is at this moment. You really don't need to go anywhere. Last week I was at a meeting of students who'd been in Prague, and I thought, you really don't need to go anywhere. The world comes to you. And this is the perfect place to study globalization. We were asked today to talk about the good and bad things about globalization, so I thought I would focus on two aspects: war, which is one of the things I often talk about, and democracy. And I want to start by saying that the first, and this is in complete contradiction to Fred, that the first most important thing about globalization for me is the end of interstate war, and perhaps I should add on a major scale. I think the formation of the modern state was inextricably linked up with war against other states, and it reached its apex in the 20th century with two horrible world wars, the rise of totalitarian systems modeled on preparations for war, and the threat for 50 years after the Second World War of a nuclear war of global extermination. I think now interstate war has become improbable. I don't rule it out. I don't rule out the possibilities that Fred Halliday mentioned, but I think it's become increasingly improbable for a variety of reasons, one of which is the growth of international prohibitions against waging war, expressed in international law, and I think held up by global public opinion. If we think back over the last 50 years to the movement against Vietnam, the movement against nuclear war, there is such a strong public opinion against global or large-scale interstate war. I think also wars become so destructive that it's become increasingly difficult to achieve political objectives by military ends. It's almost impossible to capture territory by through military means unless you simply kill people, unless you perform genocide. And we've seen this in Grozny with the Russians, we've seen it in Bosnia. And finally, of course, increasing military interconnectedness, interdependence in the military field. I think nowadays only the United States and China have the capacity to wage war unilaterally. And so for all those reasons, I think the end of the Cold War marked a striking break with the past. It marked a return, perhaps, to the globalization era pre-1914, but I don't think we can reverse that once again. I think we will look back in 100 years' time, and what will define this new era, and I do agree very much with Tony Giddens that this is a new era, what will define this new era that began at the end of the 20th century will be the end of organized mass destruction. And that, I think, is just terribly important. Of course, that doesn't mean that war is over, and here's some bad things about globalization. On the contrary, there are all kinds of wars, but wars of a different kind. There are what I call new wars, which are taking place in places like Bosnia, Kosovo, Africa. They're kind of mixtures of wars fought for political ends, massive violations of human rights, organized crime. They definitely relate to the underside of globalization, to inequality, whether it was caused by free trade or the collapse of authoritarian state sectors. I don't want to get into that debate, but nevertheless, they're caused by insecurity, they're caused by transnational criminal groups, transnational nationalist and fundamentalist groups. I could talk about it at great length, but they're definitely the underside of globalization. There are what I call spectacle wars, which are long-distance air wars of the kind we've seen NATO engage in Yugoslavia, the Americans engage in Iraq. Long-distance air wars fought with high technology, with very few casualties on the side that's conducting the war. And maybe the kind of clash that we might see with China and Taiwan or India and Pakistan might be of that kind. And finally, there's humanitarian intervention. And what I mean by humanitarian intervention is actually the enforcement of international law, the laws of war, human rights law. What I mean is direct protection on the ground. I don't think NATO's war in Yugoslavia was a humanitarian intervention. I think a humanitarian intervention might be what's happening in Sierra Leone, in a weak sense was what's happening in Bosnia, also in East Timor. So the bad thing is the spread of spectacle wars and new wars. Now what about the other aspect I wanted to talk about? Democracy. Well, I think one of the very good things about globalization is the worldwide demand for democracy and for participation. I think it is a reaction, it was a reaction, to the overbearing state of the mid-20th century. I think just as deregulation and neoliberalism was a reaction to the overbearing state and led to the explosion of global capitalism, so was also the demand for a redistribution of power. I think the global spread of citizens' groups, NGOs, social movements, and so on is as much a part of globalization as global capitalism. But what about the bad things? Well, I think one
is... Two more minutes,
okay,
firstly.
Bad things, and then a final, very quickly. One is that despite the demand for democracy, it's more and more difficult for states to respond. Yes, states do still matter, but their freedom of maneuver is much less. Decisions are taken at intergovernmental level. States are kind of agents of globalization, and that means however much citizens try to ask for things, it's more and more difficult for states to respond. What address do they, who do they address when they make a new demand? Do they address the IMF? Do they address their states? And the result is growing frustration and apathy and disaffection with formal politics. The other bad thing is the growth of nationalist and fundamentalist networks which make use of this frustration, that react against globalization, that are reclaiming the state, and that contribute to the new wars. So, this is my final point. I've rushed through it. This is my final point. I think that one could talk about two options for the future. One is a world of new wars and of spectacle wars, of nationalist and fundamentalist networks, an anarchic world, what you might call wild globalization, characterized by inequality, transnational crime, all kinds of things that are the bad side, the underside of globalization. And the other is a global, what one might call a global civilizing process, strengthening international law, the laws of war, humanitarian law, human rights law, enforcement through humanitarian intervention, and an active global civil society which would put pressure on global institutions as well as states to respond to the new wave of citizens' demands. And that's really why I'm very positive about Prague and Seattle. Of course I'm against violence, and I don't agree with many of the things that that groups are saying in Seattle. I don't agree with against globalization. But what I really feel very strongly, and watching Prague, I felt even more strongly, that young people there are expressing solidarity with the victims of globalization, and they're demanding a global response. They're putting the idea of a global civil society, by which I mean a rule of law and a global public sphere, on the agenda. And I think that's the only way to civilize or tame globalization.
Thank you very much, Mary. Just to prove what Mary was saying about what a great place this is, next Wednesday at 6 o'clock in the Hong Kong Theatre, Misha Glenny, who is a distinguished writer on the Balkans and who is a visiting research fellow at the Centre for Study of Global Governance, he will speak on what he has recently witnessed in Belgrade. You may have read his articles in the Times, but Misha Glenny is a great authority. And he will speak about the Kostinica revolution, if that is the word for it. Okay, the last speaker is John Gray. John Gray is a distinguished philosopher. You may have read his book, False Dawn, which is a very powerful critique of globalization. And his latest book is on two faces of liberalism. John Gray.
Thank you very much. Like the other speakers, I would begin by saying that I think it is actually true that there is no more important forum in the world for discussion of globalization than the LSE, so that I think all of us here should count ourselves lucky to be able to have the dialogue we're going to. We are having now and will have, continuing not only today but after that. I want to say a few things about globalization and keep it fairly simple, because I think each of them is quite important. The first is that globalization, and here I agree with the other speakers and with our first speaker, Tony Giddens, isn't either good or bad, it's both. Globalization is a huge world historical transformation, and I think it's best understood not in terms of the present global framework, the global economic regime of free capital flows, deregulation, and a free trade. The deeper transformation which globalization signifies is another phase in worldwide industrialization. That's to say, although globalization is complicated, although it has more than one source, the core driver of globalization, in my view, is technological. And what globalization really amounts to is ever widening and ever deepening interconnection in the world between economic and political and cultural events driven by new technologies which abolish or significantly curtail time and distance. That's really what I think we should understand globalization to be. And if we understand it like that, we'll see it isn't absolutely new, though it does have some very new features today. One can go back to the 1860s and 70s when the transatlantic underwater telegraph cables were laid as one of the watersheds of globalization. If we think of globalization in this more fundamental, deeper sense, not identifying it with our present global arrangements, our present global institutions, or our present worldwide economic regime, but seeing it as a very powerful, indeed in my view, wholly inexorable process driven by the interaction of human beings with new technologies. If we see it like that, we can see that it began in the 19th century, it went on throughout the 20th century, which for most of it was not a period of a worldwide free market. It was a period containing many dictatorships and wars. But globalization in the deeper sense went on, carried on. Its basic imperative, I think, is technological. And that has an important consequence, at least as far as I'm concerned. It means that deglobalization, in the sense of reversing or arresting this immensely powerful historical process, is impossible. there will be no deglobalization and there will be no relocalization of the economy, in my view. I think those possibilities are illusory. On the other hand, the present set of arrangements in the world economy, the present global regime of supervised by the WTO and the IMF and other transnational institutions, could well turn out to be quite short-lived. There are important stresses in it. And among those stresses, I think, are the ones that others have already mentioned, the outbreak, the eruption of anti-capitalist activity in many parts of the world, using globalizing technologies in order to resist the present global regime. But I have to say that if the present global regime breaks down, I don't think, like others, I don't think, like Fred Holliday, I don't think it will be because of those protests, primarily. If it breaks down, which I think is entirely possible, it'll break down at its strongest link. The strongest links in the current global economic regime concern the strongest states. The United States, Europe, taken as a single economic entity, and China. If there is a breakdown, it'll be because cooperation between states founders, fails, or is weakened. And here I want to express a note of skepticism about the belief or the faith in transnational institutions. Transnational institutions as we have them in the world today are created by, funded by, or often actually not funded by, sovereign states. Their authority, their power, their influence, their money, their leverage is all borrowed from sovereign states, especially from the most powerful. And they can withdraw it. They can disregard it. They can leave transnational institutions powerless and paralyzed. One of the key things to understand about the present moment in the history of globalization is, it seems to me, is that we are living in a somewhat anarchic phase of globalization. We are living in a period where there are transnational institutions, there are transnational business corporations, but they don't run the world. Contrary to what some critics of globalization, as well as some supporters of it, think, these institutions seem to me to be weaker, more vulnerable, more easily dislocated than is often thought. The more sobering truth is that no one runs the world, that no one's in charge, that globalization is a process that, like the earlier phases of industrialization, no one controls and no one's governing or is directing. So one of the key points I want to try and transmit is the scale, the magnitude, the profundity of this change which is taking place, and which on the positive side has some immensely important advantages. I think there's a kind of ongoing cultural hybridization happening in the world, whereby the world is not becoming a bland, sterile, antiseptic, homogenized place. It's becoming more diverse as peoples who are separated geographically, scattered about the world, link up through the internet, through satellite television, preserve their cultural identity, renew it, develop it, but also interact with others and deepen a kind of hybridization which is going on. I regard that as being pretty wholly beneficial and desirable. It's a mistake to think that globalization only brings with it problems, risks, dangers, or costs. It doesn't. It has some very positive aspects to it.
Two more minutes.
At the same time, and here I must comment finally on what I take to be the largest risk, there is a profound risk in the present circumstance in which a weak, slightly fragile, even somewhat fractured set of transnational institutions is not managing, not coping with, not guiding, or not directing the underlying process of globalization. And of all the risks which could be focused upon, including the risks of war, including the risks of inequality, I think there is a greater risk than any of those. The largest risk concerns the worldwide impact of undirected, uncontrolled, unmanaged, and even not very skillfully improvised globalization on the world environment, on the actual natural environment of the planet. Within a short period, there'll be twice as many human beings on the planet. Many of them will be very poor. Many of them will be ecological refugees. The absolutely bottom line for the risk and the peril of globalization, and remember there are very important benefits, possibilities, and advantages, is that it could leave the planet itself half-wrecked.
Thank you. Rich array of lectures, and I think it's very important that our speakers have disagreed with each other. I think it's the most important thing in university. We have to learn. There can be profound disagreement between people who often have access to the same evidence, but they draw different conclusions. And then it's up to you to draw your own conclusions, because we are not going to tell you whether the globalization is good or bad. That's your problem. Okay, well, what I'm going to do briefly while you are gathering your thoughts and thinking of very short, succinct questions, and I'll stop you if you make a speech, I'm going to sort of throw open to the panel of speakers a chance whether they want to come back and react to something which has been said. This will be a short sort of interlude, and then we can kind of proceed in about another 10 minutes. We will proceed to taking questions from all of you. Anybody want to go first? Tony, do you want to go first? Yes.
Well, I will.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Maybe you should.
No, Tony, you go first, because you went first, you go first again.
My role in life.
Absolutely. So then everybody can attack you.
I'd just like to say a few more things about the issue of inequality, because, of course, the issues the other two speakers spoke of, violence, ecological degradation, they're core issues for us, but so is inequality, as Fred quite rightly pointed out. The various key questions which everyone sitting here, I think, should try and make up their mind about. Are the inequalities which we see in the world the result of globalizing processes, or are they because people are left out of those processes? I feel on the whole that they're the result of second of these, that in a way a whole continent, Africa, is left out of these developments, and we must provide a fruitful engagement for both groups of people and countries that are left out, so that economic development is possible. Second, I think we only know of one way to overcome poverty. Redistribution can make a difference, of course, within countries. Anti-poverty strategies can make a difference, but by and large, we only know one way of overcoming poverty, and that is economic development in which the poor participate. I think the last period of world history, the last sort of 10, 15 years, has been dominated by neoliberalism, by a form of market fundamentalism, which is, I feel that reign is not wholly over, but ideologically is largely over. You cannot have effective economic development without the role of active government. Active government, I think, is crucial to counter some of the effects of the market in terms of not just inequality but insecurity. We have to discover a role for active government which is different from that of the 60s, because when people thought that the state could lead in everything, it didn't work. It didn't produce economic development by that means. So globally, I think Joe Stiglitz is right when he left the World Bank to say that you need a new relationship between conception of active government and certainly forming some kind of role for markets, but not an unrestrained role for markets. Third, I think that the issue of Tobin tax, that is having a taxation on global currency transactions, which has been around for about 30 years, should be seriously contemplated by world governments. I don't think there's been an effective global debate upon whether or not it's a feasible strategy, but I don't see myself as an implausible strategy, especially in an age of global high communications, where you can actually trace electronically, soon be able to trace the movement of money very precisely across the world. So I feel, at least at this period when there are quite a number of left of center governments in power in the EU and elsewhere, where we can, by the concerted action of government, make an impact on the world inequality, that we should look at that issue in a very serious light.
five things that governments and states can do. Three of them I acknowledge before Kennedy's book, or seemingly, or the very beginning of the century, and all the more surprising and refreshing one before Kennedy, who is broadly a structuralist historian. Number one, education and re-education. How did Singapore get from being basically a mud flat created by the British, with a population of 3 million, to producing half of all the computer scientists in the world? They did it for education and re-education. This is something which is within the purview, within the control of every single society, every single government. It happens to be the business we're all in. I discount the literary union's government, but I think more than ever this is absolutely key. Number two, the position of women in public, political, social, and economic life. For enormous reasons, and in my view the norms are slipping, the last decade has not been on balance positive for gender relations worldwide on any. Every society is responsible for the way in which it treats women in court and relations. Thirdly, nebulous it may be, but in any government or any institution, I see this through coming here, you know when you ain't got it and you only have got it, the quality of leadership. The more technology driven, the more unstable, the more global we live, the more leadership matters. And if you think political leadership doesn't matter, then if, when you've got, you know, Boris Mihailovich as your president, you do know about it. When you've got rulers who are thieves, as in the case of many countries in the world, or half of the states in the world are basically kleptocracies. But that's what they are. They're ruled by thieves. And everyone knows that. And there's no fault of origin. I mean, the most obscure countries, all their culture is very different. The first thing they do is, our rulers are thieves. Everybody understands this. So the quality of leadership, those two things, and there are two other things. The education, here I agree with John and I underline it, the education of the public, global responsibilities, of which environment is a very important one. And here, I'm not running for office anyway, so I'll say, I want higher petrol taxes in all the countries. The Americans should be paying three times for the legal way they are paying. And the Brits should be paying more as well. And of course, nobody who is from an oil-producing state will agree with me, because they think this is an OECD luxury design. Not that I disagree with them at all. But where was that voice? Where was it after 30 years of environmental propaganda by governments, by NGOs, on where were the politicians who got up in this country during all these wretched petrol strikes after and said this is an outrage that the future of humanity depends on getting a handle on this? The whole world is in denial on the question of multi-passing power. The whole world is. Because those are what they want. And this is an area where governments can do something. And finally, an area which governments, but more important societies, can do something about, which is a particular national disgrace of the British, I say, is the press. We are a responsible we are a responsible press which discusses issues, including international issues. And we have a media that doesn't waste our time on all the garbage they give us every morning evening in this country. You cannot have a responsible national politics, and you can't have a responsible international politics by any. And this is, if we have the disgraceful press we have in this country, you can just go out any morning or turn on the television any evening, I've said it before, I'll go on saying it, is an absolute disgrace. It is a responsibility of society. It's not globalization, it's not imperialism, it's not the World Bank, it's not the Americans. It's the fault of people to print, write, and sell and advertise in these papers. So those are five things each society can do better to be global.
I can see the headline in the Sun tomorrow. Mimi left at LSC. Criticizes Tony. Tony's Tony wants more tax. But I'm glad that you applauded on that nice tone of higher fuel prices, and I entirely agree on that. Mary.
Okay. Three comments. One. Yes, we need government, but what's happened has been a reaction to the over-centralization of states, the excessive power of states, and the fact that many states were kleptocracies, or they were totally dependent, or they are even today totally dependent on institutions like the IMF, so they can't actually carry out the sorts of policies. Maybe they can carry out some of the things that Fred was saying, but they're very constrained in what they can do. So the answer to the centralization of states, the answer to excessive power, it seems to me, is not less state, which is what the neoliberals said. It's state at different levels. It's much more local government, it's much more power at local government, and it's also on crucial issues like the environment, like human rights, like war, it's more power at a global level. So that's what I would say about more government. Second point, human rights. Fred Halliday said he thought on the whole the world was worse for human rights. I've no idea, actually, we should be producing those figures, whether violations have gone up or down. There's no question that the new wars taking place in the world involve massive violations of human rights. They kill mainly civilians. 90% of the casualties in wars are civilians, and they go through all kinds of horrible atrocities. So in that sense, including systematic rape, torture, all the things that consist of the worst type of human rights you can imagine. So I think in that sense, yes, it hasn't been very good for human rights, but in another sense, I think there has been an enormous change in terms of the human rights regime. There really is something we can call an international human rights regime now. Although it's still only in Europe that you can go to a court in Strasbourg, the idea that you have some kind of redress in international law, the idea that as a local human rights group you can address the international community, that you can make links, that you're not alone, that states aren't closed, that is an enormous change and an advantage in the world that has to go on and be strengthened. So it's good and bad on human rights. And then a final point, the possibility of deglobalization. I think the big risk of deglobalization is actually not China, but America. America is, if you like, the last nation state, the last frontier of globalization, and that's in a way why this election really matters. We've seen America going in a different direction from the rest of the world on anti-ballistic missile defenses, on the International Criminal Court, on the death penalty, on all kinds of very important international issues. And I think there is a real danger that if America moves to the right, that could be open up the possibility of deglobalization. The only thing I would add is that I wonder, and this is where I come to what John Gray was saying about deep processes and technologies. The world is now so interconnected. I wonder whether even for America, it would be possible for it to cut itself off from globalization. Even for America, which is much bigger, which has much more power, there are so many possibilities of transnational connections across borders, of campaigns, of public debates. But even for America, I question whether this is possible.
I'll just make a few brief comments. I entirely agree with what's been said by the previous two speakers on the importance of not further tearing down states. One of the big errors, I think, of the 90s was to read the coming century as if the principal danger to humanity would be overmighty totalitarian states. That was true in the 20th century, in my opinion. There couldn't have been any of the great horrors and atrocities, the Holocaust, the terrible prison camps in many parts of the world, including the former Soviet Union, couldn't have happened unless you had totalitarian states and regimes. So it was true for most of the 20th century, it seems to me, that the main enemy of human freedom was an overmighty state. It's not true now. In much of the world, there is no modern state at all, or it's collapsed or become deeply corroded. In parts, much of Africa, parts of Latin America, much of post-communist Russia, Southern Asia, there's no state to speak of at all. And if we're to have anything resembling a proper human response to the challenges of globalization. We need modern states because we need them to monitor environmental impact. Unless you have a modern state, it's no good trying to have intelligent tax policies if there's no state to implement them, or if the state which is charged with implementing them is weak or fragmented or controlled by criminals. So we actually need modern states, and we should get over our fetishistic hostility to the state, which we inherit from the totalitarian century. That century's gone. If there's a risk in the new century, it's much more, it seems to me, of anarchy. Second point, which follows from that, it's very difficult to control the spread of technologies in a way which stops them being used destructively. And it doesn't mean it's impossible or that we should despair, by no means. But we have to realize it's a jolly difficult task. One of the examples I would give you is the proliferation of nuclear weapons technology, which despite the fact that the most powerful states in the world had a strong joint interest and they bent a lot of effort to keeping the nuclear club small, all they achieved was to slow its expansion, so that there are now many parts of the world, many states in the world, which have nuclear weapons. It's jolly difficult to do. So we should try and focus on the immense difficulty of these tasks, not to give up, but to strengthen our resolve and to strengthen the institutions which we have, which in many respects I think are rather weak. Final point is that I think a very important error is made by those who think that globalization means having exactly the same regime or exactly the same way of life or exactly the same values everywhere in the world. There are undoubtedly human needs, human goods, human evils, which are universal. No one enjoys a short life of sickness and impoverishment. We all need good, clean water, clean air, safety in the street. We all need freedom. We all need the ability to practice our religions. But that doesn't mean we need to have the same way of life, the same regime. And the idea that there's only one modernity, that there's only one way of responding to globalization, now what globalization really means is a single, uniform, worldwide civilization, is I think a fundamental error, and it leads to one of the risks we're facing, which is excluding countries which don't correspond, or peoples, or parts of the world, which don't correspond to that one single conception of what civilization should be like. So you then have the dangerous, to my mind, pernicious doctrine of the clash of civilizations. You then have the argument that people who won't, as it were, join in making the world a single type of place, bringing about a single regime, are actually dangerous. And then we have a new cause of war. That, I think, is one of the real risks we should strive to avoid. A highly globalized world should not be seen as a world in which differences have been stamped out of existence. It should be seen as a world in which differences are encouraged in many contexts, particularly in contexts of belief, religion, way of life, and culture.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now, can we have the lights on, please, so I can see the faces of people asking questions? And can I see where the mic people are wandering around the world? I can't see anything. I'm going blind. Okay, there's a gentleman there. Now there's a gentleman here who's waving a paper in a incendiary manner. Can you have him first? Or he'll... Can we have the lights on, please, somebody? Cannot be beyond human ingenuity in the globalized age to have the lights on. Thank you. Yeah. Okay.
Glenn Siegel.
Keep it short.
Yes, very short. I'm chairperson of the Political Studies Association Specialist Committee on Globalization. Would the panel not agree that there's a connection between globalization and regionalization? And what is the significance of this for Europe?
Very good. Okay. Starting with John Gray.
I'm worried about ideas of fortress Europe. I'm worried about ideas in which Europe could hive itself off from the rest of the world and protect itself from the rest of the world. In the first place, what gets into Europe and what doesn't? What's inside Europe and what isn't? How much of former Eastern Europe gets in? Does eventually post-communist Russia get in? What about Muslim Europe, Christian Orthodox Europe? I'm skeptical, indeed, I'm suspicious of conceptions of regional, transnational government which can be used to exclude people, to protect a favored part of the world from interaction with the rest. And I say that as being someone who, in most respects, is strongly supportive of European institutions. But I'm worried about that kind of way of using them.
Even works at European Institute. You've got to be careful, you know.
One of the problems is that regions can mean Europe or North America, or it can mean Bavaria or Scotland. And I actually think globalization does mean greater regionalization, both whether you're talking about Bavaria and Scotland and whether you're talking about Europe and North America, because what I think globalization involves, what information technology has meant is an enormous complexity, and it means that at every level of society, decision making is more complex. There has to be more independent, autonomous decision making, and that's what it really means is that decision making has to take place at many different levels. And so I think the regional level, whether you're talking about the sub-regional or the macro-regional, is becoming very important. One other point, this is the point about diversity. I think also globalization, on the one hand, unifies. You have more and more people speaking English, more and more people respecting universal rights, but at the same time, it also makes possible an increasing diversity. And that means that sub-regions, people enjoying their own languages, their own cultures, actually becomes more possible, and globalization can and more desirable. The only danger is, and that's the danger we've seen in Yugoslavia, it's a danger I think that could happen in northern Italy, it could even happen here, is when they want to create new, tiny, closed-in nation states that exclude other people, and then it can be very dangerous. But that's also part of globalization.
Anybody else want to say?
I just have some more questions.
Yeah.
Two aspects of one aspect of globalization is culture. And while you see regions of the world where people don't trade with each other, they do have common cultures and common senses of humor. Very important. Arabs don't trade with each other, but they do have a common music, they have a common sense of humor. Latin Americans have a common sense of humor, a common music. And this is an important part of globalization, but the one that doesn't correlate with either necessary security relations or with trading with each other. The other end of regionalization is regional peacekeeping. Everybody's supposed to be in favor of it. Yes, China is in favor of it, which is valuable, and he said in the end, he's in favor of it. But regional peacekeeping can easily become a bully and a block. And I think that may be something which is both solved.
Good. Next question. All sorts of people. No, sit down. The woman there. Now, the woman there, yes.
Thanks. The increased number of interventions in the last decades were probably done in the name of international...
Can you speak up? Because there's also the old theory to worry about. Speak up. Give your name, speak up.
Okay, my name is Juliana Johan. The increased number of interventions were done in the name of international or global community. But every time one intervention was discussed, the debate about whether to intervene or who and how was mainly driven by national interests, and because it involved military intervention, the very corporations that are transnational, but they do lobby their own governments. So my question would be, if the old divide between North and South region poor would not eventually be replaced by those who intervene and those who are intervened and who decide, and then the question is, how are we going to institutionally design transnational organizations that would be accountable, transparent, and it will bring the corporations and the NGOs accountable also. And And how are we going to make them succeed where UN failed and not to have the P5 or the G7 controlling them? Thanks.
That's too long. Okay, I'm going to take one more question. One question from there, the gentleman over there.
Hello. My name is Jay Motwani. I'm an MSc student in international relations. John Gray spoke of the need to move away from the idea that globalization equals homogenization, and I'd just like to point to two things and then see what your ideas on them. In Spain, companies are now encouraging their employees to...
No, keep it short.
Okay. No siesta, because it reduces efficiency and competition. In Germany, you used to grow up and you die with welfare, with your company paying your health insurance. They can't do that anymore because, again, it reduces efficiency. Globalization is changing people's ways of life and people's culture without necessarily them wanting to. Is there a choice between cultural integrity and economic development?
One more question I'll take. The person at the back there. Now wait till the mic gets to you. Stand up. That's better, so they can see where you are. You know, talking about leadership, this is all about leadership.
I just wanted to talk about probably what most of us think is the most important debate. How is globalization going to help Africa? And generally speaking, all these developing countries, I think you went over it briefly, but is globalization in the medium term and in the long term going to help their health, their education, and so on? Or, as I think Professor Halliday was mentioning, would they be better off without globalization, or it won't affect them at all?
Thank you. Let's take that cluster of questions. Who wants to have first go? Tony, do you want to have first go or any of that?
No, just listen.
Okay. Anybody want to have a go at them?
Well, Fred Raj should answer.
Mary, you're the interventionist. Okay.
Usually everybody wants to speak.
Exactly.
Okay, first of all, humanitarian intervention. I think that when humanitarian intervention has taken place, it has been a combination of things. It has been very often something to do with national interest, but there's also been tremendous pressure from NGOs, from the global media, and so on. And it's very hard to say which of, it's like the old arguments we used to have, it was welfare state, the result of trades union pressure, or was it capitalists discovering this was a better way to run society? I mean, in fact, it was both. And I think that's also true of humanitarian intervention. I think it gets worrying when, as I said, humanitarian intervention does not involve the direct protection of people. And that's what was worrying about the intervention in Yugoslavia. I think it's very important that humanitarian intervention should be internationally authorized, that it should be an international process. And I think it's very important that we find ways to increase the transparency and accountability of transnational institutions. We do need United Nations reform, and we do need mechanisms through which there is a genuine public dialogue about global issues, and through which all the kinds of pressures we've seen in Seattle can really result in changes in our institutions. On the issue of cultural, I think in a curious way, of course, globalization is good and bad. I mean, I think globalization has led to much greater insecurity. This is much more sort of Tony's sort of subject than mine, but it's led to much greater insecurity in jobs, but it's also led to much greater independence and autonomy. I mean, people have a much greater choice in the kinds of lives they lead, the kinds of education they do. It's much more difficult. It's much more competitive. You aren't assured of cradle-to-grave support, and I would like that to be the case. But at the same time, I do think it's a very, there are lots of exciting challenges. You can do different things than you could do in the past. You can have much more interesting jobs than you can have in the past. We're very sad about the decline of manufacturing, but at the same time, a lot of those jobs were extremely boring, and their children are doing much more interesting, well-educated jobs. So it's a plus and a minus. And finally, Africa and the rest of the third world. Well, we want, I think, and I, from what everybody else has said on the panel, I think they do too. We want Africa to be part of globalization. We don't want it left out. And what that may mean is that it can't be left simply to companies. That there has got to be intervention by political authority on a global level I realize I keep moving away from the mic. There's got to be political intervention on a global level in order to be sure that the victims of globalization or the people who are left out are brought in. And that won't happen if globalization is just an anarchic process. And that's why Prague, Seattle, that's why international institutions are important, and that's why they have to be reformed so they don't just serve the interests of the rich countries. And that's why there's a big agenda, maybe a utopian agenda, but it's a very important agenda.
Donny.
Can I just say something in response to the last question? I probably sort of expressed myself very ineptly when I said right at the beginning, because it's about the whole notion of globalization. It's an ugly term, isn't it, globalization? Well, but it's also a kind of portmanteau term. Some people think that you should now forget the term altogether, because it's used so widely and it covers so many things, and I have some sympathy for that. So I think some of these questions, some of the ways in which globalization is discussed as it's sort of reified, discussed as though it were a single phenomenon. It is not. It's surely a kind of transition in the nature of world society, I think. And that's why I think one must resist the idea of saying, for example, are you better off without globalization? Because there's a complex set of changes going on which offer enormous possibilities, I think, for the world. But there are manifest and obvious, really serious dangers that we have to try and control, which you can't simply lead to global marketplace, absolutely can't. But I think there's something fantastic in all this, which is the first age of globalization was late 19th century, as I said and John also said. At that time, there was a real possibility. People really thought the things that Mary was saying, warfare, might become a thing of the past. People writing books about global governance. People thought you could have a peace for the world with global cooperation. And what happened? You had the rise of hatreds in Europe, ethnic hatreds, ethnic divisions. You had two world wars. 200 million people have been killed in the 20th century in war. In the 21st century, we absolutely do not want to repeat the pattern of the 20th. So what's to play for is, can we wrench our history away from that pattern? It has to be an open question, because you look at what's happening here. If you look at the rise of right-wing parties in Europe this very moment, some of the countries we thought very liberal countries, like Denmark or Norway, there are more than 25% of the population supporting far-right, anti-immigration, xenophobic parties in those countries. You have this eerie feeling that the 20th century might repeat itself over again. But I think we can stop it, and I therefore think it's crucial for well-intentioned governments, civil society groups, NGOs, other organizations, international organizations, to get a grip. I actually think it is feasible. I think we can break with the past pattern of history, but there's a fabulous amount to play for in all this, and that's why this debate is such an important debate to master. For everyone in the LSE, but for people in the wider society too, it is the debate of our time.
Either Fred or no. Okay. Next cluster of questions. A lady here had caught my eye. Can she have a mic, please? Oh yes, yes. Well, you know, I will get to you. Is there a mic up there?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
There are several, I think.
Sure. Sure. Can you work that out? I'll go upstairs now. Yeah, the gentleman there.
Hey me. Hello.
Yeah.
Right. Benjamin Geer from the Friends of Le Monde Diplomatique. I'd like to ask the panel if what investors are looking for when they go on the global market is in fact not good government, but rather bad government. They want the weakest labor laws, the lowest minimum wages, and repressive police forces that can prevent strikes. The result being that many people continue the manufacturing jobs that are no longer available
in
Europe.
Can you keep it short? No speech.
Right. In so-called...
What's the question?
The question is, I mean, is what can be done about this? What kind of international legal or other sort of framework can prevent starvation wages in sweatshops.
Thank you. The gentleman, you got it working, have you? Okay. Yeah.
I think that's working now. Deborah Cass from the law school.
Speak up, please.
Deborah Cass from the law school here. I want to ask about the assumption that there are a lot of states outside of globalization. All we need to do is bring them in to make them happy. In fact, many of the states who are supposedly out are in, like states in Africa and who have been subject to, you know, many programs of the IMF, etc. And many other states are part of the WTO structure and have been subject to trade liberalization, which is often what we mean when we talk about globalization. So they're in, but they're obviously getting...
What's the question?
The question is, what is globalization going to do about those states which are in, not about getting them in because they're there already, particularly in the context of the discussion that was had earlier about the inequalities which are being generated. And the point made, I think, by Professor Giddens was that these countries were just simply not participating in the benefits of globalization. Well, in fact, they're there,
okay.
They're at the table. What is globalization doing for it?
Thank you. The lady, the person there, yeah. Yeah, second row from the... Keep your hand up. Stand up, yeah. That might help. Thank you very much. Yes, sit down. It's all right. I can see you. Stop getting excited.
My name's Colin Hines, author of a new book, Localization, a Global Manifesto.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Flyers in the Mezzanine. End of ad. Question. The reason that people in Seattle had a banner saying worldwide fight against globalization was because they defined globalization as something wholly negative, opening up markets, increasing inequality. And they talk about an internationalist, supportive way for protecting and rebuilding local economies. That localization is beginning to emerge as an end goal. My question to the panel is, what are their end goal for this century? In terms of international economics, and how might it be achieved?
Thank you. One more question. I will go down there, the gentleman here.
Do you think that democracy is compatible with globalization? To me, I'm not sure.
Thank you. I think that was... May I commend that as an ideal way of asking question? Is everything should be good? Is it the case that if there's not, I shall shut people up? Up there, who wants to ask a question? The gentleman there. Yeah. Yeah, you. Come on, ask a question.
Hopefully, equally short. How do you propose to get a grip, as Tony Kidd mentioned, how should institutions change to handle globalization better?
Thank you. I think there are a cluster of questions on similar kind of topic. So let's take them and then we'll come back to other questions later on. Who wants to have a go? Who wants to stay there? Yeah, right.
Goals for the end of the 21st century, simple one. That we should live through the next century without major interstate war, and that's to me the primary one, that there should be a radical reduction of what has been a trend since the beginning of the 19th century, the global inequality. I mean, broadly speaking, top 20%, lower 20%, the gap was 3-1, probably in 1830, it's now, as we know, 6-1. We can certainly get that massively down, and I don't think that it's inherent in capitalism. So why? Only because the people are poor. 3 billion people in the world with less than $2 a day income. How on earth can they buy it? Thirdly, that we should see and promote creative diversity of cultures and language, and I repeat, in university cultures. And most importantly of all, that the unfinished agenda of human rights, individual rights, but also collective rights of ethnic groups, rights of workers, so forth, that this should be realized. We don't need more revolutions. What we need is the carrying out of the agendas which the revolutions of the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries have laid down. And on this, I would disagree in one respect with John. I agree with him that we do not want a homogeneous world, but I do not believe there is any culture out there, any civilization out there, which does not want a broad universal form of human rights. I think that if there was a free plebiscite of women in Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Afghanistan, they'd tell you pretty quickly what they wanted with regard to public equality, dress codes, and the rest of it, and the freedom of it. If people, countries where allegedly they don't want democracy, you'd soon get a pretty clear answer. And I think the Serbian answer in recent days is a good one. On the question of the countries where there is horrendous and growing inequality, it's got to be some package of three things. Good governance, because for all the debt relief we're hearing about, I'm all for debt relief, but if you've got corrupt governance, it's only postponing and recycling the problem. Good governance, education, and foreign investment in technology. Those three things are things that can make things turn. But you won't get one without the other two. It's easy to say this, but that is the formula.
We've heard endless times that the world can't do this.
I don't see why they can't. And this century, they have no alibi. The last two centuries, they had alibis. This century, they don't. So let them do it.
Very good. Who else? John, do you want to have a go? You've been quiet for a while.
A couple of comments. I'm glad someone mentioned, I think it was Tony Giddens mentioned the rise
Can
of...
Can you get it closer to you?
Yeah, the rise of right-wing movements in Europe, because I think that reveals a very important truth. The right-wing, far-right movements which have been arising in Central Europe, not only in Austria but in other countries, are important, particularly those arising in very rich countries. After all, the reemergence of a radical right is happening not in a context of economic crisis, not in a context of high unemployment, but in a context, in Austria at any rate, of a country with almost the lowest unemployment in Europe, 3%, I think, roughly speaking. So the idea that rapid economic development, which is absolutely necessary, particularly in parts of the world which lack it completely, but the idea that it's a panacea, that by itself, that you simply like a kind of benign Prozac in the body politic, it removes these risks of atavism, removes the risk of a reversion to Europe's terrible history and to other parts of the world's terrible history, is simply an error. It's a very dangerous error. It's clearly falsified. So the notion of making the world rich will somehow get rid of all these problems ain't going to happen. That leads to the what one could hope for the present century. I mentioned three things. First, entirely agree with Fred Halliday, no major wars. Any other hopes that we might have would be forfeited if there is a recurrence to major war. The second is that the whole, everywhere in the world, every country, can benefit from the new technologies that are coming about. And here I agree with those who say really, there aren't any countries which are outside of globalization. All are affected profoundly by it. Africa, after all, is in the condition that it is and has the problems it has, partly as a result of globalizing processes which have affected it profoundly. There's nowhere which actually can insulate itself or which stands outside of globalization. And that's for the third thing, really, which I still think is actually the most important, which is dealing with the truly global environmental effects of the new technologies. One reason why no human community can stand outside of globalization is that some of the effects of these new technologies, particularly on climate change, would have an effect on the whole world. The effects would differ from country to country to some extent, but the living conditions of everyone in the world will be transformed if what the majority of scientists, I think, who studied these issues carefully, now thinks is true, which is that some changes in global climate, very complicated, hard to be sure what causes them. It's clear that some aspects of global industrialism have an important impact there. So the final thing I would hope for is that this encounter between humankind and its planetary home would actually result not in catastrophe, which I think is possible, but in a better life for humankind. That seems to me to be the precondition, actually, of anything else, because we're not going to get less inequality if much of the world is environmentally ravaged.
I'd like to respond to the much admired question on democracy. I think globalization stands in an interesting paradoxical relationship to democracy. On the one hand, if you look at what's happened in the past 30 or so years in the world at large, by even a tight definition of democracy, there are about three times as many democratic countries in the world today as there were 30 years ago, even allowing for the fact there are a lot more countries in the world than there were 30 years ago. I think there is an inherent structural connection between the spread of global communications and democracy. When you have a more open information society spreading across the world, it tends to mean that communications and democracy. When you have a more open information society spreading across the world, it tends to mean that the old forms of power, authoritarian power, don't really fit with that society. So what's happened in Latin America and elsewhere, if one can sustain those democratic changes, very, very important. I think a democratic transition for large parts of Latin America is really possible. We've achieved it in Europe, I think, in countries that had an authoritarian past, like Portugal and Spain. I believe it is possible to achieve the same thing elsewhere. On the other hand, the very same thing that's producing a spread of parliamentary democracy is also undermining it, as one can see. And that comes partly back to the applause that Fred got when he mentioned newspapers, because the media also stand in a double relationship to democracy. The reason why many people are disillusioned with politicians, disillusioned with orthodox politics, very much bound up with the very processes that actually have spread democracy across the world. And we have to try and resolve those things. We live in a kind of media democracy in which politicians address the media and which parliament tends to become sidelined. It's been very acutely analyzed by some political scientists at the LSE. It's a disturbing situation, especially when you connect it with monopoly control of the press, and when you have two press barons who are against the euro, who are not even from this country, are able to sway amass the population of this country, that can't be right. You must try and create, therefore, a more effective democratic space, and that, to me, is a crucial role of progressive politics. The issue of localization, countries that are left outside, two questions that were linked, those are crucial, crucial questions. I think that local economies have, under some circumstances, to be protected. That is, it's not right simply to open up local economies to global markets without other structural changes. These often have to be political, though, not economic, because in so many countries you've got poor or corrupt governments, as Fred said. A lot of the problems of the world come down to government, not simply to markets alone. It's crucial for people on the left, I think, to learn to recognize that, because the traditional idea of the left is that you can blame markets, or you can blame capitalism, or you can blame the Americans, or now you can blame globalization for everything. And putting things back in the hands of the state will resolve these things. It won't without structural transformation of the state, but that can both protect and develop local economies. It's crucial to involve all countries of the world, to me, in globalizing processes, and the richer countries must allow more space for less developed countries. In international organizations, they must allow more dialogue, they must allow more exchange of direct aid as well to less developed countries. But this is an agenda which I think is feasible. The United Nations set the target of halving world poverty within 25 years. It's a feasible objective. We should have a global war on poverty in which our country and other countries play an active part. And these changes could be achieved, I think, by collective political will.
Mary.
Well, I also wanted to answer the question on democracy. In fact, it was part of what I was trying to say, but it got a bit compressed. I agree with Tony. Well, as I said, the worldwide spread of at least democratic demands has been a critical feature of the last few years. But I do think there is a real problem that the capacity of the state to... what you want with democracy is to be able to influence the decisions which affect your lives. And if the decisions which affect your lives are not being taken by the government you elect, then however perfect your democracy on paper, in practice, in substantive terms, democracy is eroded. And I think that is the big, big problem that we face today. And I think, and that's again what I was trying to say, but in a very compressed way, that is one of the reasons for the rise in nationalist and extreme right-wing groups. People feel a tremendous sense of disaffection with politics. They say politicians are all the same, they're the creatures of the media, they don't offer us any choices. And of course, part of that you can blame at the hands of the politicians, but partly it is because their capacity to do anything is tremendously constrained. And in extreme cases, in many developing countries, that capacity to do things is so constrained that in a sense states have imploded, and that's where you get the kind of new wars that I talk about. So it seems to me that's a really very important question, and there isn't a simple, straightforward answer. It's only if we can find new forms of democratic mechanisms, both at a global and a local level, that I think we can restore democracy. And that's where I come to Colin Hines' question. I do think the local becomes more important with globalization. I think there are a lot of important decisions that have to be taken at a local level. There's a lot of autonomy that's acquired at the local level, but that autonomy can only be acquired through some relationship with the global. I think what you can't have, and that's what in a way the fundamentalists and the nationalists are asking for, is a closed local space. You can't cut yourself off from the world, because then you really suffer. And I've seen enough, I mean, whether you talk about Republika Srpska in Bosnia or whatever, to know that, in fact, the only way you can gain power at a local level is somehow by having direct access beyond the state to the regional or global level. And so I am for localization, but I think I think that's crucial. That's one of the answers to the democratic question. And then there's a final point, the question about being left out. And I think the lady who asked the question was absolutely right. It's wrong to say Africa's left out, because there's the pressure of the IMF, there's the pressure of liberalization and so on. So it's part of it. But the problem is that Africa's left out of the institutions. I mean, the problem is, okay, so they have membership in the World Trade Organization, and the interesting thing about Seattle actually was the breakdown inside the World Trade Organizations between the developing countries who felt they were being steamrolled by the rich countries. That was what was interesting. And so the real question is, how do you give third world powers more, not whether how do you cut them off, but how do you give them more power to influence global regulations? I think that's the only way that those countries are going to improve their position in the world today. I mean, I do take the view, and that's probably where I differ with people in Seattle. I think actually, at the moment, we don't have free trade. We have asymmetric trades. The rich countries close off their markets to the products which poor countries mm-hmm. make. We only have free trade in the products which rich countries are good at making. And so what we really want is free trade in the products which third world countries are good at making. Yeah. We don't want them to simply close off their markets. And so that means third world countries or poor countries need to have much greater power at the global level.
I think you're a very smart audience. You clapped in all the right places. We have unfortunately run over. Before I say anything, I want to thank, on behalf of all of you, and you should thank, Amanda Goodall, Gary Delaney, Judith Higgins, and their colleagues, who have invisibly, efficiently, and beautifully made this possible. So we must thank them.
And lastly, let me say, never believe anything which is said from the platform. Thank you.